This is a Momentum Media production.
Welcome to the Pure Property Podcast. Whether you are considering buying your first investment property or reaching property mogul status, we dissect the fundamentals through to large-scale property development and everything in between.
G'day. Hey, Yowen. Pure Property Podcast with Paul Glossop, Director, Pure Property. Hope you're well. Thanks for tuning in. It's for our monthly instalment where we go behind the numbers, go behind the scenes, go behind the stories, go behind the anecdotes, go behind the BS to try and help unravel, uncover how to do property investment better than everyone else. And that's what the game is. Most people, if you surround yourself with the right people, you can win in property investment. Fortunately, there's a lot more information around these days to help you be a better property investor. One of them is this podcast, I would like to think. But this show is not about me. Not many things is about me, to be fair. But this show is about Paul Glossop, the director of Pure Property Investment. I get him in and we sort of try and unpack what's going on in property markets, but get a real world insights from those people that work with Paul and clients that work with Paul as well to try and see how they're going about it. But today it's just me and him in the studio because there's something I want to talk about, and it's probably something that most property investors at some point in their life will start thinking about. And my recommendation when they start doing that, I say, don't do it. But he might tell me otherwise. Paul Glossop, how are you going?
I'm well, mate. And I probably agree with you that what we do end up talking about, and you'll uncover it in a second, no doubt, is that
Don't do it.
Yeah, the don't do it world is it's fraught with danger.
Yeah.
Big upside, big downsides.
Yeah. So what we're just talking about here is property development. So most people shouldn't go into business for themselves. Much like most people, most property investors shouldn't develop property. That's a big generalization, but let's look at that. Australia is a home of small business. There's about 2.5, and I'll probably get these numbers a little bit wrong, but bear with me. They're accurate-ish. There's about 2.5, 2.6 million businesses in Australia. I think by memory, there is about 3,500 large businesses. That's companies over 200 people. Mm-hmm. There's about 55,000. I'm close, but you get the idea. There's about 55,000 medium businesses. I think that's like 20 to 200, and the rest are small, right?
Yep.
2+ million small businesses in Australia. The average small business, I don't know, 50% or something fail after 2 years, right? So most businesses fail.
And this is one of the big points and reasons.
This is the fact, right? That a lot of people shouldn't go into business for themselves. You know, it's hard. It requires a certain set of skills, certain set of mindset, all this sort of stuff. This is not a show about business, show about property investment. And Pure Property, what they do is help investors from all walks of life realize their investment plans and their strategies. And sometimes it includes property investment. But my point is, most property investors probably shouldn't do property development.
But it's probably a relatively similar percentage of developers who make money, break even, lose money when you look at business owners and people who start up within particular finite periods of time, people who buy property to essentially make a profit. No one tries to develop property to make a loss. It's very rare that someone would intentionally want to do that.
Yeah.
It's probably happened in the past and no doubt is for some tax outcomes. But the side of property development, there is a lot more detail that needs to be gotten right because it's far less forgiving than passive property investment. And it basically is breaking it down to say you're buying property for an active outcome in a finite period of time versus what we talk about far more than this, which is buy property, well located, manage your cash flows, give it a decade, and the rest should work its way out. It's certainly not that, and that's not the outcome that you're typically trying to achieve when developing property.
So for most people, we'll stop this podcast now and go and Google capital growth calculator and have some fun and just put in a property or properties if you have them, put your portfolio in there and give yourself a conservative 5% average annual growth.
Yeah, very conservative. 5% will be below the long-term average, but 5% will be
5%. Put in, do it for 10 years, then do it for 20 years and you'll see some numbers and you'll go, there's no way in the world that it works that way.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, maybe not, depending where you're buying your assets. But if you look back over time and you look at long-term trends, that's what you should be expecting as a property investor. And I think Paul's sort of running some numbers right now around it. So this is more of a passive approach to property investment where you buy good quality assets in the right place at the right time and you hold on to them through good cash flow management, whatever that looks like for you, and just sit it out. That's okay. Yep. And that doesn't mean you don't have to do anything. You're going to be active during that process. But sit it out, and you're probably going to get the result that you want, Paul.
Yeah, mate, you're absolutely correct in the sense that if we go back to your comment you made a second ago, if you buy a $500,000 property and you give it 10 years and you average a 5% average annual compounded growth to that property, not factoring in paying off debt or, you know, things like any kind of negative gearing or cash flow issues, et cetera, $500,000 property becomes an $814,000 property within 10 years' time. Within 20 years' time, that same property goes from $500,000 in value to, drumroll please, and if I bring that up, I will tell you that it immediately goes to $1.326 million in value over two decades at 5% average annual compounded growth, which is a great return. Now, the difference between that and buying property to actively get an outcome is that you just simply aren't having that amount of time to work with. You're trying to buy a property, you're trying to then invest in that property, turn it from one into two or possibly four or eight or 15 or whatever it might look like, and make a margin. And I guess the bigger difference in this, in addition to finding properties which stack up, if you do your numbers and you know your numbers very well and you have the skills and all the processes in place to do so, is you also have to find a partner in this. And the partner is much different than passive property investing. The partner that I'm referring to is the bank.
Mm.
The bank's not there. The bank has to be there for two reasons. First and foremost, they have to lend you money to buy the property in the first place. Now, if you buy a property that has a dwelling on it that's habitable, effectively you can buy it as an investment property first and foremost. That's the easy part. The hard part is putting together a feasibility that literally a bank will read. And they have to stress test it first and foremost, and then they have to have their numbers lining up with your numbers to say, we like your numbers, well, they're in line with what we expect, therefore here is your XYZ cash to then go and knock down the building, develop the property, sell it, make the profit you want to make, and pay us back our money plus a whole bunch of interest and other fees that we're going to charge you on top.
So they're two very complicated bits, but that's the easy bit. Finding the place and then getting the finance on that place, and then subsequent to that, getting construction finance or development finance. And then you actually got to do the development bit, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not here to talk down developing property. I think it's a really good way, if you will, geared and configured to make substantial amount of money inside a property investment, but it's not for everyone. Now, a lot of people would say, well, you can't go wrong with property development because we're told every single day, and it was only a press release I saw coming out today, we're not building enough properties. So therefore, what we're going to do is build a place and you'll sell it. Well, yes, but there are so many moving parts that unless you're equipped with the capabilities yourself and or you're very good at managing a team, there are so many spots where you can come unstuck. And coming unstuck in property development can be really unstuck. Like at best, if you come unstuck, you get your money back and you don't get any profit. And that happens more than you think.
Oh, yeah.
The other end of the spectrum, and it happens a lot, is you lose money on it, right? And that's because the market changed, the finance position changed, the Reserve Bank changed. There's Houthi rebels in the Red Sea who are disrupting shipping and therefore things become more expensive and I can't get stuff on time, therefore I have to pay more interest, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll go into some of those cascading issues right now. So I just wanted to front end this podcast by saying, most people, this is probably not right for them. Just stay down a path, well-worn path of a more predictable approach to property investment where you get the benefits of holding on to property and getting long-term capital gain. And I often sometimes sit there and just go, stuff all this. And I have to get a capital growth calculator out and go, well, I've got this much debt. I've got this much debt, which I'm paying, however much I'm paying on a year. And I control this amount of property, right? And I'll sit there and I'll just look at the arbitrage between if my debt doesn't change and what I'll pay over 10 years versus the upside. And I always come back to the point, and I actually did this last night, late at night, because I was just property. And I went, I need to control more property. It was what my thought. Yeah. I went, what am I doing? I need to control more property because if you do it right, the upside is huge. Mm-hmm. And you start sitting there and you look at the numbers and you go, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. But why am I wasting my time? And then I still go down the pathway going, maybe I should be more active.
Yeah.
You know, I could develop property. You know, yeah. I reckon I'd be pretty good at it personally. But I ain't got the time to do it, you know, right now. And I don't really have the inclination or the drive for it. I'd rather make money elsewhere. But for other people, it can be a really good way to go about creating real good wealth in property investments. So that's what I want to talk about today, Paul. Not why you shouldn't do it. Let's talk about, and I think we've covered that, why you should do it and how you should do it effectively and where it can go wrong and where it can go really right. And I know you've done it. A number of developments yourself, which have been good. Have you blown your dough yet on development? Have you come close yet? Have you sort of looked down a barrel and gone, oh, this is bad? What's your overall sense of property development? You like it?
And this is probably going to paint the wrong picture because this is what I spend my life doing. I'm probably better than most at knowing the numbers and knowing what makes sense and what doesn't. And that goes from not only a purchase price to what a resale product looks like, to what a square meter, a cost rate of a build would be, to knowing zonings, to knowing timings, to knowing who to work with, who not to work with, which builders, which bankers, a whole range of things and essentially part of that process. To answer your question, mate, I'm probably on track now to develop pretty close to $100 million in property separate to a passive portfolio. Out of that $100 million in property development, active property development, there's been one site which I didn't develop, which I bought, got approved and sold.
Mm.
And the reason why we sold it, and this was with one of my development partners, the reason why we sold it is that I basically put my foot down at a meeting once we bought it during COVID. I actually bought it whilst my business partner on this development was on a yacht in Sardinia. And he had to sign in front of a banker via a Zoom call with no shirt on, sitting on the front of a catamaran, had no idea. And he knew his numbers as well as I knew him, which was very, very well. At that time, this was a commercial deal in Sydney for a 1,240-odd square meter warehouse. It was an old fibro, essentially tin warehouse, which was going to be a three-story, 14 warehouse construction. It was very large, 16 meters. And we actually got it. We bought it, paid best part of $4.5 million for the site, got it CDC approved. And for those who are not aware of CDC approval in New South Wales, there's some changes a couple of years back, but basically meant we got this thing approved without going to council. So we had it designed, approved, and essentially ready to turn soil within about a 3.5 month period of time. In that time, what we're doing our math on for construction costs was about $2,200 a square meter to build this. And it was predominantly going to be concrete, tilt slab construction in some parts, et cetera. When we ended up getting the final feasibilities and we got three quotes from three builders who gave us those initial numbers, but then went through the final approved drawings with engineered drawings and specifications, worked out to be about $3,700 a square meter. Now, we had our end sales projected on that particular site to be somewhere in the vicinity of about $16, $17 million. We bought the property for about $4.5 million. We had the original construction was going to be around about $6-ish million. We're going to be all in for about 11 to 12, depending on where certain things were going to land. That blew way out to about 14 million. So the margin, whilst there was still a margin technically, it was just before interest rates started to rise. And my knowledge was that we were in a very, very precarious spot because interest gets capitalized on construction. Interest obviously gets applied to the actual dwelling itself. There's no income during the 2.5, 3 years that this construction was going to take. And I looked at the numbers, I'm just not comfortable with this. We ended up selling the site within about 8 months after buying the site. I think we ended up selling it for about $5.5 million minus GST. So about $5 million that we ended up selling it for. Didn't lose money, made a bit of money. Mm. And it certainly wasn't time wasted. But look, I actually drive past that site regularly.
Still there.
It was actually, we sold it to someone who didn't use the DA. And this is an interesting insight too. They didn't use the DA, they bought it. Turn it into an owner-occupier for essentially it's a huge studio. They've done a beautiful renovation to it, but they bought it for an owner-occupier for a business and done a huge, huge restoration on this whole property. But it gave me some vindication in the sense too that like I wasn't going crazy with my numbers because I look at it right now and I was like, we'd still be halfway through that, knowing that I'd be holding that debt at about 8.5%, knowing that construction costs were there. The market hasn't tanked as far as the end sales would have still been about there. The margin, and I've got a few other developments underway currently.
Yeah.
I would have had to have probably pulled out of one or two of those others because the cash flow constraints would have just been too great. So it would have had a domino effect to other developments.
So this is the key to development. It's being completely unemotional to it and know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
100%.
Pardon the analogy there of one of the great songs of all time. But if you're going to commit, you've got to commit. If you're not going to commit, you've got to get out of it. And I know a lot of people, they get burned by development. They do it once wrong. Like most people buying resi property the first time, you do it wrong the first time, you get stuck, right?
Yeah.
And then you get burned and you probably don't touch it again. So it's knowing when a development asset stacks up. And we can have a chat around that in a moment. But you mentioned the end product. So you're building industrial.
That was industrial, correct.
Okay. So you probably wouldn't go too wrong on if you had those assets today for sale. You probably do well. Industrial's pretty hot, you know.
The end sales were the same.
Were they sort of like
they were between about 100 and 250 square meter internally with mezzanine.
With a mezzanine, yep. So real stock standard stuff.
We're trying to hit a market that we knew there was going to be plenty of end buyers for these investors, etc.
So like a small like a logistics center with an office upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to hit a mass market because we're not building a product that's going to be really hard to flog. It was sort of saying, hey, this is a good product. We're actually going to hold two of the products ourselves because we knew that they were probably going to end up with a margin, which meant that we'll sell what we need to break even, keep those, run them through and get a much higher return.
Your profit was holding.
The profit was going to be a hold and a net return and some depreciation in addition to that, and then take the equity out and then reinvest that elsewhere.
So did you have the finance approved to do the build?
No.
Okay.
No. And to get the finance approved to do a build of that nature, and much, much smaller for that matter for anyone who's listening, is that you do have to technically, again, going back to what I was saying up front, you have to have a feasibility. You have to have a fixed price building contract most of the time. That fixed price building contract also gets vetted by the bank. So that contract, not only does the contract get vetted, it gets vetted by essentially a QS. So then the QS, so a quantity surveyor has to then look at saying, what does this quote include? Are they missing things? Because all of a sudden what we don't want is a variation of 20% to what they had, which then all of a sudden the bank looks at it saying, well, hang on, there's no margin left in this development anymore, yet we didn't see it. So the QS, and you have to pay for the QS too, by the way. Mm. They don't pay for it. You pay for everything. So QS report, I've got some drawdowns on a particular development right now, which has got 8 QS reports involved in it. It's about $30,000 after all said and done, every single one of them cash. You can't borrow that money. You have to find it somewhere to pay for every single one of these reports at every drawdown phase. But that gets vetted then. And not only does the development have to stack up based on that, then the bank, they want to vet the business because they're not just backing you. They're backing the builder. So they want to know, is this builder someone who's done this before? And they actually want to see the financials. So the amount of times I've worked with banks who ask me to say, okay, great, yep, stacks up, we're happy to give you the money. We just want to run the numbers on the business. So then I have to get in touch with that builder. And that builder typically, they have to be on top of their numbers because they have to divulge typically 2 years' worth of financials to the bank to show what their P&L is as a business. So they want to know that they're—
Which a lot of builders don't like.
And a lot of builders are hopeless, unfortunately. No disrespect to builders out there, but if they're builders who are running their business really lean, and for obvious reasons they're running it lean, but you have to run a profitable business and you have to show it over a long period of time. So, and they can, that's a subjective decision. They can say, no, we don't like it. And that's happened before. And then I have to find another builder. Mm. So that's after everything stacks up. The bank essentially can still say, no, not going to touch that builder. And then you have to go find another builder. And that builder might be 20% higher than that previous quote. And all of a sudden you say, this doesn't stack up. So I don't even need to talk to the bank because I can't use that quote.
And people are asking now why there's not much development going on. And this is exactly the reason why.
and this comes from a process of having huge amounts of experience already. Mm. Like I can do a lot of these numbers in my head prior to it because I'm very, very familiar with certain types of construction, certain end products, what we're going to include, exclude. Is it above ground? Is there basement? Is it a class 2 building? Is there fire rating issues that have to get overlaid with all this? All these things start to add up and you become very good at being able to run these without talking to anyone. And it's not most of the time when I'm going to a bank, it's because all that work's already been done, but you're still in the lap of the gods.
So you were holding on to, using this as an example, you were holding on to this property, which was not generating you any rent.
No rent. It was just empty. Vacant.
Okay. And you're paying a premium on your interest rate.
Absolutely. At the time when I bought it, it was just above 4%. But knowing full well that we had one rate hike at that time and the writing was on the wall for me pretty obviously to say this is not going to last. So we need to make, hence why we went down the CDC route and we're going to get this done as quick as we could to try to minimize.
So you'd be knocking on the door of 10% now if you still held on to that.
It was going to be about 9%. We'd be holding 9% construction debt on probably $8 million in construction debt right now.
So the lender that you had it with, would have you done the actual construction finance route? Would have had to go into like a mezzanine?
No, it was going to be through a big four at the time. They'd already backed us on it. Well, they said if the numbers stack up, we didn't get to that point, but if the numbers were as per what I proposed, then that would stack up and they would lend us. So, you know, real back of a napkin math, we were holding $8 million out the door there at 8 or 9% on that construction loan. This doesn't take into account the additional fees and other things because there's plenty of those as well.
So your interest costs
were about $700,000 a year on the build.
Yeah.
Now they were, for the most part, they were going to be capitalized. And for those who are sort of unfamiliar with what I'm referring to there, is that they essentially get added onto your costs at the end of the build.
Yeah.
But the actual, the land itself that we bought, you have to pay those interest costs. We would have had to pay those on a monthly drawdown.
So the original asset that you purchased for the land with a four and a half mil shed on it that you're going to knock down, so call it the land. So you've got to keep up with interest repayments for the period of time.
Yep.
That's okay. you got to find that money somewhere.
Yeah, that's $250,000 a year for that. Yeah.
And then $250,000 bucks a year for that, and then another $700,000 in interest payments. It's $1 million a year, but you capitalize the back end of that.
Yeah,
so you've got to make sure there's enough margin if it takes you three years to build.
And that's why delays in construction, all of a sudden, you don't just freak out.
$2.1 million in interest repayments.
And every month that passes by, you start to do your math. And for anyone who thinks, oh, you're building property is simple, you start to think, wow, the risk. And then you think everything that's out of your control. So a builder goes bust, COVID happens, anything else that can delay a property or a development by 1 or 2 months, rain delays, weather delays, anything. Christmas time, for anyone who's not from Australia and comes over here during the mid-December to mid-Jan, if you're a builder from overseas and you come here, you'd be absolutely appalled at the fact that you can't, building stops for a month.
Yeah.
And you're holding every bit of that debt. So you've got to factor these things in. You can't think that you're going to change that outcome. You just got to accept it and absorb it. But these are all of the risks. And I guess to your point, Phil, that's one that comes to mind for me personally, that yes, I didn't lose money. I made a little bit of money, but you know, there could have been much, much. And again, as I said, the end fees on that particular product was $2 million in the green or in the black, which probably was going to be eroded by the holding costs. Hence why we pulled out, because yes, whilst gross, it looked like it was there. Once you factor in a couple of extra years of holding costs at those types of numbers, there was no chance that
all the supply chain shortages, you can't get the labor,
all of those
you can't
risks.
Get the building stuff. It's all there. And again, it goes back to, there's a shipping crisis somewhere in the world.
Absolutely.
And I think containers to ship out of Europe to Australia now is like nearly twice the price because it's got to go around.
This is reminiscent of 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we knew that, you know, pallet costs all of a sudden, they went exponential. They went 10x within a 6 month period of time. Mm. You just have no control.
You have no control, but fortune does favor the brave or the bold. There's not many brave people around at the moment. Hence the reason why development is really stalled, because developers is the big problem. Developers can't make money. We've spoken about it elsewhere. You have this big groundswell, at least in resi developments at the moment, where people, there's certain areas of the parliamentary system, the government, the opposition and independents out there sort of banging a drum around, you've got to make development, you've got to develop more stuff, you know, and the private sector won't develop because there's no money in it. So they're saying, well, the government should do it. Well, why would the government do it as well if they're not going to make any money off it, right? It's a big issue.
It's huge. And you probably, therein lies sort of another big part of when it comes down to when we're doing feasibility is the T word, tax. Mm. It sucks because you think, well, you know, let's go flip it on its head and let's find a site that makes sense and all the numbers work. Even when it does work, the tax man wants the money.
Mm.
They don't give you a credit when it doesn't go right. They all of a sudden say, look, you tried, you failed, you lost money. Yeah, you don't owe us any tax, but you know that money you lost. You know, it's very hard to then figure out, well, what do you do next? So if you do win, you get punished for it as well. There is no concessions as a developer to not pay tax. There's no benefits in that space. There's some build-to-rent models that are starting to come out. But again, you have to be in a very, very elite group of developers who have to then be eligible to be able to go into that space as well. So essentially, you have to be one of the top 10s in the country from a development standpoint. So when it comes down to how do you get involved, you have to risk so much to build so little in this country to make a return. But when you do win, you know, people are on your back. When you lose, people say, mate, you're greedy.
Yeah.
And but invariably, there's always going to be the overtone of we don't have enough supply. That never changes.
We're stuck at the moment. Not enough supply, but no one can make money out of building.
Yeah.
So how do you change that?
Well,
like, should you develop is the question. Like, I don't want this to be a podcast about why not develop.
That's a current live spreadsheet of mine right now that I'm looking at for sites that I've got active right now. Now, these numbers I plug into once a week and I have to update because I get updates on – I've actually had a missed call from a builder of mine right now who's been on air because I know there's a certain stage of construction from
– He wants his money.
But no, he gets paid his money on his installments. What he wants is he wants an answer because at the moment where we had a specified stone or an external cladding, it's going to be intruding from a certain boundary. And where I had a 900-millimeter tolerance, I've probably got an 870-millimeter tolerance, which the council's not happy with because it's not up to the minimum requirements. So now I'm going to have to send back a huge pallet of certain stone that's already been paid for. And he's probably going to say, mate, what do we do here now? Because we're going to have to reduce that from 30 mil to probably 15 mil to get this through council based on the survey.
The council won't like the stone they specified.
They don't care. They don't care. They just said, no, that can't happen. Figure out another solution.
Yeah.
So there's about 15 grand torch that we'll have to figure out a solution to. But I guess where the solution is for me and I guess why I'm very lucky because I can actually dedicate my time, efforts and money to looking at sites all day, every day, is that most people just don't have the ability to do that in their day in, day out vocation. I look at, and I've probably got a good couple of dozen clients as well that I'm looking at for sites in very, very early level or entry level price points to quite high price points across Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth as we speak. But when it comes down to it, there's just very little that ever stacks up. So you need to be extremely good with your numbers, and you need to be extremely good with your understanding of local government zonings and requirements to let know what can and can't be put on particular properties. You have to know how to very, very quickly assess, does it make sense, does it not? Know exactly what your construction costs are going to be within a variation of a few hundred dollars per square meter. And then you need to know what your sale price is going to be, either per square meter or per dwelling, depending on what you're building. You need to know all these things well beforehand before you're actually buying a property. This just comes down to that whole mastery, you know, essentially the 10,000 hours. Much of this just comes down to trial and error.
So from a philosophical point of view, should you go into, if you go, okay, I'm a property investor and I've got quite a lot of properties and I've tried my hand, I've built a couple of granny flats, no worries. Yep. I've built a new, I've done a knockdown build, knockdown rebuild. I've done pretty well out of it. It's time for me to step up a little bit. From a philosophical point of view, should you approach development as in trying to prove that it's not going to work or proving that it will work?
I always like to think if you're starting out, and I started out this way, and I'm first to admit that I started out small. And most of the time, depending on where you come from, but vast majority of people aren't starting out with a luxury four townhouse development or a industrial warehouse complex or whatever it looks like. A simple 1-2 lot subdivision or a duplex development is typically where most people cut their teeth. The reason why they are typically quite good is that your default when you don't make money, which unfortunately most won't, if you do it too soon, if you held the property for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, going back to that math of compounding that we did at the start.
So if you do it the flip, you won't make dough.
It's the same math. You've got to figure out, well, how do I buy this and turn it into this and make money within 2 years without the market doing any of the lifting for me? Mm-hmm. That's what you're relying on. You basically say, I need to artificially inflate the price of what I'm going to provide. I can't factor in growth, and I never factor in growth into my summaries and when I'm doing my FISOs, because essentially that is fool's gold. Mm. So the beauty about thinking about building a 1-2 lot or a duplex is your default is usually a pretty soft fall because you can hold it.
Yeah.
And if you start at a lower price point, if it fails and you don't make money, then you're usually going to look at it and say, okay, well, I've gone from a $600,000 purchase. I've bought a 1-2 lot and I don't have to touch the house, so I can squeeze a battle axe or something else out of the back lot. And I might build a $500,000 entry-level kit home there, factor in another $75,000 in council contributions, approvals, etc. I might be in for 1.2, 1.3. You know, you're assuming you can sell it for more than that. Let's say you don't, but usually then all of a sudden you're holding, let's say you finance the whole thing, you're holding $1.2, $1.3 million in debt. You can then all of a sudden be left with probably two properties which will rent relatively close to neutral, factor in a bit of depreciation, and it's forgiving. It's a cushioned landing.
Yeah.
So you're not risking at all. So if I was giving any advice to anyone who wanted to have a crack, not that I think it actually makes sense, because even if you're making a margin of, say, 20% on a $1 million development, you know, 200 grand upside, if you're selling, remember that you all of a sudden, if you're selling, let's go back to those same numbers. You buy a $500,000 property. Let's say you put $500,000 in, and I'm just going to round these numbers, and you go from one dwelling into two, and those two dwellings are worth $1.2 million, you spend $1 million after all said and done. So there's technically a 20% margin or 200 grand gross margin in that. Out of that, you've got to pay a sales agent to sell both properties. So all of a sudden, then you're going to the fact of saying that's about 25 grand in sales costs. You're usually going to be having somewhere around about at least 12 months worth of interest repayments that were unencumbered or, unpaid for in some way, shape or form. So let's say that's about another 25 odd grand. That's interest costs, which essentially is going to be negative. So that's about, where are we at? We're about 50 grand there. So from 200 down to 150. And let's assume that out of that 150, you might have other things like styling costs, advertising, and a range of other things to sell the two properties. And I'm assuming you go into it and actively get out of the whole thing. Mm. So you're probably going to torch another let's say, give or take 25 grand. So let's assume you made 125 grand or 12.5% on that type of example. From there, you're usually going to give away straight away another 10% GST back to the government. So you're going to torch another 12.5 grand. So you're back down to then now all of a sudden 110, 115.
You're going to get tax advice on that.
You're going to get taxed on that profit at the end of the day as well. So depending on what kind of company trust structure, whatever fraud structure you might have, a personal name, et cetera, expect to give away a minimum 25% of that profit. So out of that whole process, if you did actively do it, and let's say you made 20% on that, you're going to walk away in that scenario that you might make 75 grand.
Yeah. And the key thing you haven't factored into that equation is time.
Oh, and opportunity cost to do something else.
Yeah. Now, how long did it take you?
Your time. And now everyone can value their time differently. And then whether it's prorated per hour or just generally speaking, I like to spend time with my family or my mates or myself. I don't care what it is. But yeah, I can attest to the fact that your investment in time obviously is usually, it's proportionate to the size of the deal because your stress levels rise, the more expensive it gets. Some people are different, wired differently, but your time is not factored into that at all. But also if I say, hey, Phil, I mean, we released the Fast 50 report, you know, last week, right? So let's go back to a couple of those markets we talked about. You spent $500,000, or let's say in that example, you spent $1 million and bought two properties at $500,000. And that scenario that I talked about there, say that took 12 months to build that development, sell it. If you bought $1 million worth of assets across two, that got you maybe just 10% growth. And that was on the very bottom end of our Fast 50 report from the year before.
Yeah.
You do your math pretty quickly. I've just made essentially $100,000 in the passive scenario.
Yeah.
And if I sell, I'm probably going to make, you know, maybe somewhere very close to that same thing by signing two different contracts of sale and going through the process to finance two separate properties.
That's on the basis of selling it. If you actually manufacture that equity up,
and paid no tax,
you can pull it out,
and you still hold retain the property. Correct. Yeah. So,
and this is the key point. A lot of people get absorbed or obsessed with property development. Right? They go, oh, it's great. Well, I think the example you just used there is a really good case in point. Is the juice worth the squeeze?
Massively.
And usually it's not.
No.
When all said and done, it's typically not. Now, the bigger the risk, the bigger the return. And people always say this around property investment. So it's got to actually move the needle. And people always say to me, Phil, you should do more development. Why are you building granny flats? Why are you doing it? I just go, it's too hard of a way to make money. Yeah. Like, and I just don't have the time for it. And if I'm going to spend time doing that, it's going to be at the expense of making money elsewhere.
Correct.
And probably a lot more of it elsewhere without a lot of the headache around it.
And we talk about a lot, Phil, and probably you might not have ever given me the credit that I deserve, but I reckon I'm your barometer on development a fair bit because we talk about stuff that I do regularly. You know, that example that I just talked about there, and I think inadvertently, at least, it gives you a little bit of an insight quickly into saying, okay, that itch has been scratched for a couple of seconds there. Forget about it. I ever even considered doing that. But we do talk about that a lot. And I guess going back to your is the juice worth the squeeze analogy, you know, I've found that over the years is that, again, I've graduated from very small developments to much larger. And it's not that, you know, I've made more money, so I want to do bigger things. It's just you realize that to do small developments, even if you win, you really don't win. That's the challenge is that you're like, what did I actually win out of all this? If I'm going to try and do this, the irony for me doing a one-inch, and I can talk about, I've got a luxury basement duplex I'm building at the moment, which was about a $3 million purchase price, is going to be about a $3 million build, and it's going to be about an $8.5 million end gross sale. There's a margin in it, and it's going to work. And that was that example of that builder that I just spoke about who gave me a call just now. That's going to work. That's a year and a half worth of work, and there's a margin in it of 20-25%. The work and time that goes into that versus me doing my first subdivision in Western Brisbane for a $220,000 house, which I subdivided, and I went fought council twice with a lawyer, and I ended up building a project kit home to the side. And I still hold both those properties today. And they've done really well because I've held them. I made at the time, I remember doing the math. I've got a really detailed spreadsheet because it was one of the first that I did. I reckon I made about $35,000 at the end of the day. And it took me about 2.5 years. But what I'm trying to get to is the time is exactly the same. For those two developments, if I was to invest my time, all of my resources, exactly the same. I'm making exponentially more dollar value for the time investment once I figured out where my craft can be deployed differently.
And this is about the utility of your capability. That utility of your capability.
Nice one.
Don't know where I got that from. It's pretty
That's
good.
Your next podcast title.
Utility of capability. But it's true. Utility capability. And I think about it myself. Like What is the utility of my capability? It's not making, it sounds a bit glib, but making 35 grand over 18 months on a property development.
No.
You know, it's an afterthought. It's a
nuisance. Money's definitely not the reason.
You know, so it comes back to utility capability. Now if you want to go down this pathway, you've got to start somewhere. One of the biggest misnomers, I'd like your views on this, Paul, but one of the misnomers, property investment, everyone goes, yeah, I found a corner block and it's a development site and I can do this on it and that on it. And like, yeah, I've got an under market value because what I can do on it and all this sort of stuff. And you sit there and just go, you're probably not going to ever develop that.
No.
You know, you ain't got the capability. You haven't got the skills. You haven't got the time. You haven't got the energy. You can't get the finance. But there's so much currency put on these type of properties. So everyone goes, yeah, it's got a huge X factor. It's the X factor. And you go, what are you going to do about it? You know, well, you're going to sell it to another investor who's got the same dream and view who'll never do anything with it, right? It's a bit of a cynical way to view it. But there is a currency around
this,
right?
Very natural default of yours.
It is, right? But it's a natural currency. You know, people go, oh, it's zoned R4 or whatever the relevant zoning is in different places. I can put a 16-meter apartment block on it. And you go, are you? When are you going to do that? When are you going to do that? And then they'll sell it on to someone else with the same dream. And probably it's still sold as a four-bedroom house on a 400-square-meter block of land in Deception Bay or wherever it is.
And Phil, I'm certainly an advocate for buying property with upside. I'm not going to suggest that buying property as a set and forget is what people should be doing. Upside helps. But thinking that you're buying a property that's got upside that you're going to develop, yes, you may, but you still just have to, if you're going to buy a property with no intention to actually ever develop it, for me, it comes down to saying, look, yes, it could have a 1 into 2, 1 into 5, 1 into 15 block subdivision upside. And I can't count how many of those properties I've bought over the years as a buyer's agent. But when it comes down to it, the amount of my clients who have actually ever done it and my recommendation for them to ever do it, I could probably count on one hand. And I'm probably being generous there too. And the reason being is maybe not because there's not a margin in it, but it comes down to all those examples that we just talked about, saying if you went off and then that property that we bought in Deception Bay is an example, and I could think of a dozen of those. I'm actually working on one right now. That's a 2-street fronted, zoned, essentially urban next gen, which is, it could go up to 6 stories. It's 3 properties side by side. They could do something with it. I know they could. To your point, rattling off the list, can you get finance? Do you have the upfront capability cash flow wise? Is the bank going to sponsor that? Do you have all of the other ducks in a row to go through this process over a 3-year period? The answer is invariably always going to be no. This can't happen for either this reason, this reason, this reason, and this reason. But have the properties done well? Yes. Yeah, they've done really well.
But that's what it needs to be.
Yeah, you know, that's why.
Irrespective of all this gonna wanna can do.
Yeah.
Does it still perform? And a lot of people make buying decisions based on the development potential of a block as the principal reason and thinking about the sort of long-term hold of cash flow and capability is the second thing. You got to completely flip it around because the likelihood of doing something is low. And then also people that chase, and it's a long game, they chase, oh, I've got this one here and I've got the street behind up one and I'm going to buy the one there and I'm going to get the one next to
Monopoly.
It.
Monopoly.
And then I'm going to get 4 all side by side and then I can do a big development.
Now I can do motels.
Yeah.
But it's Monopoly, right?
Yeah. You must see that all the time going, I've got that one, but they're not linked, so I've got to get that one there.
Yeah. And it's a double street frontage. I've got a bit of a dog leg here, Bob. There's an easement that runs through that one, so I don't want that one.
Yeah.
The chances of these things ever coming off, I mean, to use and wait and not deploy your funds elsewhere in markets that are doing far better things, it's fool's gold. It always will and always has been. I mean, I've bought plenty of side by side 3 in a row, 4 in a row, 6 in a row properties before, and as a buyer's agent, you get pretty good at being able to try and figure out and have connections to be able to link properties together. And we do that a lot. But for an individual to go out and try to think, I'll buy this and I know because my mum told me or my next door neighbor told me that property is going to come up for sale because it's an estate and all this, that I'm going to get in there because I've got this one at the front and I'm going to buy that next one in the next 5 years because I reckon they're going to move into a retirement home. Honestly, use your energy and your money elsewhere because you will get a far better return.
So should you develop property?
Absolutely. Look, I'm certainly always been a glass half full kind of person, although this glass next to me is questionably half empty and was drank by someone else invariably.
You'd be surprised. Glasses can be deceptive if you want to use a metaphor.
It's far more voluminous at the bottom.
About half a litre of water can go into that glass, even though it looks like it's a thimble.
No doubt. But I guess for me, it comes down to everything in life, Phil. You didn't start this business to do podcasts.
No.
this was something that came from something else, which came from something else, which invariably opportunity happened because you're like, you know what, I've been in this game, I've seen that, now I get that, I know why we do it, where we do it, how we do it, and essentially have the audience for it. Things happen usually, and property development is, if we're looking at the hierarchy of property investing in general, property development typically sits very close, if not at the top of the pyramid. Mm. And the reason being is that you have to use so many other skills that you have to collect and develop over the years to get to the point where you can actually do that and stay there and not go broke whilst doing it. So my word to the wise for anyone who wants to get into that space is start where you've started, Phil. Start where I've started. Start where most people who have a successful property portfolio have started, which is buying what they understand, buy what they can afford to hold long term, and keep buying those properties for a good long period of time. If you're going to have a crack typically at something you bought a long while ago, because usually that's where the most margin's going to be and it's going to be the safest place. You don't and likely won't make much money out of it, but you will learn some very valuable lessons. And that will probably then catapult you into the decision of, do I want to do more of this? Or was this a lesson learnt? And it was relatively inexpensive when it turned out. But yeah, don't start too big and try to avoid anyone who thinks that it's really simple, easy money.
And don't want to be a wet blanket on this, because I do concur that developing property can be a really good way to manufacture wealth,
yep,
if you get it right. But you only ever hear about good development stories.
Yeah.
You just never hear about the ones that have gone bad, because most people try and hide them, don't talk about them, don't publicize them, or they blow their dough.
Yeah. Like,
there's a good reason why a lot of developers go bust.
Absolutely.
Right? Is there intrinsically connected with property development?
I've got a client of mine who called me last week and I didn't know, but they had an option on a property not far from where I live actually. And he called me up and said, mate, do you want to buy this property? Came out of nowhere, didn't know they owned it. I know the exact property because I didn't know you owned that property. Well, he didn't own it, as it turned out, an option on the property, which he's had for about 2 years. It was a $150,000 option fee, which he had a handshake agreement with the neighbor who was going to allow him to access his property, and he was going to bowl them both over and essentially build a center access, six townhouses, three of which were going to be on a golf course. The neighbor just wanted one of the end products on the golf course for use of his land.
Mm.
As it turned out, that agreement went pear-shaped. He got, you know, he probably spent about 180 odd grand in approvals, developments, had this thing fully spec'd, not approved, but fully spec'd, and from every consultant worthwhile getting into, had it all ready to go. I've got all the documents in my inbox because I looked at it and thought, is this something I could get into? But when it came down to it, I looked at the agreement that's in place with this neighbor, and they're still there and they're still shaky on whether they want to go in or not. I was like, mate, how could you enter into a $150,000 option fee with nothing ironclad, which forces this person to actually go down that pathway? So what's end up turning out is that they've changed their demands, that they not only want the property on the golf course, but they also want the one at the top. And effectively, I want two out of the four, and it just doesn't stack up. But this all changed halfway through it. So he called me up in desperation because his option runs out at the end of March. And if he doesn't find a buyer for the property at the price that he's got the fee on, then he loses his cash.
So he had to pay the guy $150,000.
We paid 150 grand to the person he bought or has an option on the property for. The neighboring property, there's no agreement, no contract.
Yeah.
So he had an option on one property with the intention the other guy would say, okay, look, you can develop over my land. I want one of those on the golf course.
So he had an option with one of the guys. He paid him 150 grand saying—
Option fee, correct.
Yeah, and you pay that up front?
Pay that up front.
Okay,
yep,
on the base you got 2 years to sort it
out.
Well,
it was negotiable. The time that you have is, but he had a couple of years.
So he's saying, hey, if I can do a deal here, I'm going to give you 150 grand.
You commit to it regardless. The money's dusted. The moment you commit, the money's yours.
And then he's paid another 180 in fees to try and get—
To get everything ready to go.
So he's in. He's in for like— a lot of dough.
Yeah. Well over 300 grand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And 2 years.
So if nothing happens,
unfortunately, it's not going to happen.
$300,000+.
Because I guess the other big thing I looked at, which took me about not only this neighbor issue, but good thing about doing what I do real quickly now, is that I looked at that, flicked it to my town planner. He said, mate, there is a huge flood overlay on the bottom third of that whole site there, because this hasn't touched council yet. So what he hasn't looked at—
Why has he spent all that money then on—
Well,
on,
unfortunately, on first time.
Okay.
First time.
Yeah.
And this, when it comes down to it, first time. And it's gone in big. And clever guy, educated, and gone in with another partner on this who's also educated and clever guy. And they haven't made bad decisions in business or finance over the years. But again, haven't done property development before.
Yeah.
So the order, the people you speak to, the process— It's so important. And if you talk about—
So one neighbor had a handshake agreement with the other neighbor, And
well, it had a handshake agreement with the person who ended up getting the option.
Yeah, okay.
But when it came down to it, they didn't, you know, you would have stipulations to say, look, the option fee is contingent on me getting approval. I would have a whole raft of other things that I would have in place in those types of agreements. But again, it's just experience.
Yeah. A lot of people peddle this sort of option, be a property investor through options.
And it's scary. It's a very easy way to lose your money.
Cards.
Absolutely. I mean, you learn your lessons, right? Like I know this guy, if he's listening, they're certainly not speaking ill of it because I know he's a very clever guy and I know he'd probably go about this very differently next time around. Yeah. And I probably bastardized a few of those points that I've gone through there, but I know full well that it didn't take me much to look through it and say, that's not a deal in any way, shape or form. It would never have been a deal. You know, effectively, I've got a free block of land out of what that was providing. So my mind is like, how can this not stack up? But it didn't take long to scratch the surface. Been like, there's a red flag. This would never happen regardless because of that flood overlay.
Yeah. And going down that pathway also, it's so contingent to the other person saying, yeah, I'm on. Or they hold the balance of power and they just keep blocking, going, no, until they get it their way. So that's the reason why they change negotiations. They want that one, but also want
They've got nothing to lose. They've got nothing to lose at all.
See, they could just put the house up on the market.
Correct.
And just go.
They could pass away.
Yeah.
You know, they could go bust. You don't know what's happening in their personal life. They could separate. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Tough.
Control is everything.
Yeah, tough. Yeah. So
there's so many lost stories that I know of out there, but I've thankfully not had any losses in the property development space myself.
Mm.
And it's not through lack of trying, I can assure you of that, because I definitely give it a red hot crack and still am and still very active in that space. But it comes down to knowledge and experience is everything.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming in, Paul, talk about property development. I hope we haven't talked you out of it, listeners, but hopefully we've talked you into being very thorough and considered, should you want to go down that pathway, no doubt the gang over at Pure Property can have a chat with you around it.
Definitely. I'm not going to talk people out of it, but I'm very rarely talking people into it. There's certain times where we do talk, you know, about it. But I think for me, it's saying, look, build a decent portfolio with all kinds of options in there. And this could fit.
Do the basics first.
Do the basics first. And this could fit into that 5, 8, 10, 15 year strategy. And it could likely in that 10, 15 years, the property you bought in the first, second, third property is usually the ones which, if it's going to make sense, it'll make sense on those properties because the margin is far greater, the risk is far lower.
Yeah, yeah. And when I've got more time, I'll start looking at this, but I don't right now. Again, it's where you choose to, where you choose to focus your time, energy, and effort. But if it's right for you, give it a crack. Go and speak to these guys.
PurePropertyInvestment.com, inquiry@purepropertyinvestment.com. If you can't find any time to schedule a time online, send us an email because we'll be able to squeeze
you in. But you're not going to want 1,000 people calling up going, I want to be a property developer. What do you want to, before you actually sit down and have a chat with someone, what do you want to see?
Look, I just want to see someone's ready to take action. Now, whether it's to say, hey, I want to be a property developer tomorrow or I want to be talked out of it today, I want to see someone who's sort of already done their numbers and says, here's where I sit. I know I can do something. And that might be that they've run their own calculations and they're borrowing where their equity sits, what their borrowing capacity is, or they've got a really clear understanding as to what they're trying to get to, but they don't quite know where or how to get them to that position. Yeah, our job is to try and formulate that clear plan to then go and put the pieces in the puzzle, i.e. the properties which are going to get them there the quickest and most seamless way possible.
So is there as many good development blocks or locations available today as what there was 10 years ago?
I think there's more, if I'm honest with you, Phil. And the reason why I think there's more is because land becomes more scarce in this country. As much as it sounds counterintuitive, there's so much spare acreage floating around out there. The actual usable land that has a margin in it, it becomes greater and greater. Now, the risk is still there. It doesn't change. But the beauty is that once you start to see more density, more population, ultimately it means that there's far less variables. So for me, the riskier markets are always the ones which are newer and far more sparse because stuff can be created real quick.
So your view towards development is infill type
development. Infill is always more confident.
Like,
It's very hard to find non-infill. You know, I know we're about to wrap it up, but I can think of a massive site I was looking at in Byron Bay about 4 years ago. And it was about 20 hectares. Ooh. And it was going to be a big investment. It was R2 zoned. It was 4 or 5 lots combined. And it was going to be circa 15 million purchase.
Mm.
Raw land. It was farming land at the time. Apparently, it already had some support. And I had two partners in on it. And one of them had already done a large development up there previously. So they had some skin in the game, so had some knowledge. And that hasn't done anything yet, but I can think of that as a non-infill, so greenfields location where there is margin there. But man, the risk and everything you have to put on line, that was going to be a decision for me to put everything I've worked over the last 15 years on the line for one all-in approach. And I'm, as much as I like taking risk, I'm pretty calculated.
And you look what happens, right? Like, and people may have been buying that stock for holiday homes and or short-term rentals, which is now blocked by the government. So, it's really, really hard. Yeah. Anyway, stories for another time. Paul Glossop, that's the Pure Property Podcast. Go and chat to these guys, check them out, pick their brains. I'm sure they're happy to chat with you. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We'll see you next time. Until then, bye-bye.
The information featured in this podcast is general in nature and does not take into consideration your financial situation or individual needs and should not be relied upon. Before making any investment, insurance, tax, property, or financial planning decision, you should consult a licensed professional who can advise whether your decision is appropriate for you. Guests appearing on this podcast may have a commercial relationship with the companies mentioned.